Engaging conversation on the most urgent problem of our day and what you can do about it.
Now, the End Abortion Podcast by Priests for Life.
Well, hello, brothers and sisters. Father Frank Pavone here, National Director of Priests for Life. Welcome to our program and welcome to this episode in our series of examining the various arguments that are being presented to the Supreme Court of the United States in the Dobbs case of the Supreme Court, which is considering abortion based on the law out of Mississippi. We are examining all of the briefs that have been submitted to the court for this very, very historic and important case on the most fundamental moral issue that we face today, that is the issue of abortion. We are very happy today to be joined by, to discuss yet another one of these briefs, by the president of the Family Action Council of Tennessee. David Fowler is going to be here with us now, in fact, to discuss a brief. But let me tell you something about David a little bit. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you. You
served after clerking for a while in the Ohio Court of Appeals. I understand that you served in the Tennessee State Senate, which of course is a very significant aspect of your bio. Thank you for serving in that way. And in regard to this issue of abortion, my understanding is that you authored an amendment to the state constitution in Tennessee, and that it was successfully enacted, and that it essentially prevented the people in Tennessee from claiming that some kind of right to abortion was in their state constitution. That too is quite an accomplishment. And you're also an author of The Politics of Loving God, and also Recovering the Constitution Using the Ninth Amendment to Recover Civil Liberty. So those, I'm sure, are just some of your accomplishments. Thank you for all of that, and thanks for being with us today.
Well, it's great to be with you, and my probably greatest accomplishment is that I married a wonderful woman and have a wonderful daughter and three wonderful grandchildren, one by marriage and two biologically, and so life is full of life, and that's what we're here to talk about today. So I'm glad
that
to be with
is you. Indeed. That is indeed, and what a blessing that is, and blessings on your family. So David, as you know, I mean, I think in this Dobbs case that the Supreme Court is now considering, I think we've reached a historic level in terms of the number of amicus briefs that have been submitted by pro-life organizations. And I think that shows the fundamental importance of this case. Let's talk first about who is represented in this amicus brief that you and our friend, also our mutual friend, Thomas Smith, have been responsible for putting together. These are family policy councils, 22 of them from all different states. Tell us what these family policy councils are and what states are weighing in on this particular brief.
Well, thank you. We're actually a network of state-based organizations that originally arose back in the, or started arising back in the late 1980s, I guess, through Dr. Dobson and the family research, family focus on the family, because they realized that so many important issues affecting the family, marriage, religious liberty take place at the state level. And we were mostly focused on the Washington level. So many of these organizations have been around, 30 years. Ours has been around for 15, excuse me. But we're all across the country. We're loosely associated with each other through an organization called Family Policy Alliance that helps connect us to one another. Just for moments like this, when there's a major issue that perhaps bringing more to the table could make a difference. And so what we all focus on are predominantly three things, I guess you could say: marriage, the nature of the family itself, life, and religious liberty issues. And so we focus on those, though, at the state level, at the state policy level, rather than at the federal level, although sometimes we will mix it up at the local government level. But that's our focus. The God's design for the family, which would be marriage and children, parental rights, those kinds of things. His design for the human person, we might say, then life and religious liberty. So in this instance, I drafted a brief, Tom reviewed it, some other attorneys reviewed it, and we filed it with the Supreme Court, and I sent an email to my colleagues, some of whom signed on to other briefs, but 22 states, organizations, representing, I don't know how many thousands of Americans actually, signed on to the brief and said, yes, we want our name on that to say to the Supreme Court, return to us the ability to protect the fundamental and absolute right to life.
Yes. Yes. And we're going to get into the legal argument that you make here, the constitutional argument. But what are the states in this particular brief, the state policy councils that have joined in?
Well, sure. I'll have to read them because I don't have them all committed to memory. But the Center for Arizona Policy, the Center for Christian Virtue, which is actually the organization in Ohio, the Christian Civic League of Maine, the Delaware Family Policy Council, the Family Foundation, which is Kentucky's organization, the Family Institute of Connecticut, the Family Policy Alliance of New Jersey, the Family Policy Alliance of Wyoming, Family Policy of West Virginia, a Frontline Policy Council, which is the name of the organization in Georgia, Hawaii Family Forum, Indiana Family Institute, Kansas Family Voice, Louisiana Family Forum, Nebraska Family Action, North Carolina Family Policy Council, Palmetto Family Council, which of course would be South Carolina, Texas Values, which just passed the heartbeat bill in the novel heartbeat bill in Texas. Then the Family Action Council of Tennessee, which is essentially our lobbying political arm of our legal arm, I guess you could say. The Family Leader in Iowa and Wisconsin Family Action. So as you can see, this is not just a bunch of states from the South. We go from Hawaii to Maine and from, you know, north to south, from Wisconsin to Florida. So it's a broad cross section of the country, which is, I think, a good statement. This isn't just, you know, the conservative Republican Southeast.
Right. Exactly. Well, I was very happy to see our own state of Florida on that list. That's where we're based here at Priests for Life, and where we're recording right now. So, David, let me summarize in my own understanding the argument that I came away with reading the brief, and then have you flesh it out a little bit. It's a very, very constitutional based argument. About the Ninth Amendment, the 14th Amendment, but basically, my understanding is the following: our right to life is pre-political. Okay, it doesn't come from government, and it therefore cannot be altered, diluted, or deleted by government. We have a right to life. Of course, our Declaration says it's from the Creator, and government is supposed to secure that right. And as I understand the argument in this brief, this right has been recognized by common law. It's been recognized as something that the states have to protect. And now, when we look at the way that the Supreme Court has dealt with the abortion issue, in order to justify the taking of the life of a baby, they have invented things and they have gone into contortions to try to say to the states, oh, you can no longer protect the fundamental right to life of these babies, which is basically what Roe v. Wade told them. You can't protect these babies in the womb. And what you're saying is, wait a minute, you can't take an amendment to the Constitution and have it then cut off the ability of the states to protect a right, which is in common law, which is in natural law, which is there already. Am I correct? Is that the summation of the argument?
Yeah. Thank you very much for making a technical legal argument common sense. That's essentially it. And, you know, I was just thinking this morning before the show, we've fallen into a trap that I don't think I even realized until this morning as I was praying about, you know, the show and God bringing fruit from it. That when we only argue about the Constitution in cases interpreting the Constitution, we're really saying that there is no pre-political law, pre-constitutional law. All law is found in the Constitution and the court's interpretation of it. And that's not true. As Christians, we don't believe that. God has established norms and laws for all of his creation, and one of those is the right to life. Now, what's ironic is the 14th Amendment says you shall not deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So it doesn't say that a person can't be deprived of life or liberty or property, but a state cannot deprive them without the person violating a law, committing a wrong, like murder, let's say, or battery, assault, theft. But you also then have to prove that wrong by a due and fair process. What's ironic is that the requirement for due process of law is predicated on an underlying assumption that there is a right in persons to life.
Right.
We wouldn't have a due process of law requirement if there were not already underlying it a right to life. Now, where the Ninth Amendment, and there's some beautiful briefs that have been submitted, sort of making that argument within the context of the 14th Amendment itself. So, yeah. For instance, John Finnis and Robbie George, Marianne Glennon have written wonderful briefs on those points. And what they're pointing out is that when the Constitution was written, it was written in terms of and in the nomenclature of the common law, and which is the law that preceded the Constitution. And so in the common law, it was very clear. The Supreme Court relies on common law all the time, and the common law said that the unborn are persons in the law and are treated as born for many purposes, like with property and estates and so on and so forth. And yet the Supreme Court ignored the common law understanding of the words person, life, and liberty in the Constitution. They just started making up things divorced from the legal context in which the 14th Amendment was written. Okay, we get this as Christians. We look not at how, for instance, in the scriptures, the Greek or the Latin might be understood today, but how it would have been understood at the time it was written, because it could be completely different, right? And so when they use these words, they use them according, this is the Supreme Court's own words, after adoption of the 14th Amendment. They said the common law was the nomenclature in which the founders were familiar. The Supreme Court said after the 14th Amendment, and has continued to say the same thing, even until this year in cases, that the Constitution must be understood in light of the common law, the language, they said, of the common law, and interpreted in light of its history. So in other words, not only did the common law understand the word life or person a certain way, but why did it come to understand it this way? And of course, what the common law said, William Blackstone and others, was, well, there are three absolute rights. Absolute in the sense that they come from God. Mm-hmm. No judge creates it. No statute creates it. So it's absolute in the sense that you don't get it from something other than God. And that was personal security, which was defined as life and your life, your limbs, and your reputation. That's why we have laws against murder, because that's an absolute right. We have a duty to protect the personal security right to life, to limbs. That's why we have laws against assault and battery crimes, as well as personal recovery for personal injuries. You know, if I just come over there and hit you and break your jaw, you can sue me for damages. And then liberty, which was locomotion, the ability to move around. It wasn't a liberty to take the life of another person. There was never such a thing. And then property. So they made those arguments. Now, the problem that we've seen with the Supreme Court is that it can find any way to weasel around its own language. And that's what it did. It took the word liberty, which meant the ability to move around without prior restraint, so that, you know, I can leave my office and go down the street and nobody can do anything to me about it, so to speak, unless there are stoplights and those kinds of things. But they just ignore sometimes the common law. And they did in Roe. In fact, in Roe, they said the unborn have guardians ad litem appointed for them for the purposes of property. And then they ignored the fact that, well, if you're a person for property, why aren't you a person for life?
For life itself. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So the Ninth Amendment forces them to recognize the common law and forces them to recognize that our rights don't come from the Constitution. The Constitution simply enumerates certain rights, but all other rights, the Ninth Amendment says, are retained by the people. That's what the Ninth Amendment says. It's never been interpreted. Yet, according to Marbury versus Madison, the seminal case for judicial review of statutes, the court said it cannot be presumed that any provision in the Constitution is without effect. So we've ignored the Ninth Amendment. We've never interpreted the Ninth Amendment. And so we offered it as a way to say to the court, you must recognize the arguments made by John Finnis and Robbie George and Marianne Glennon and those people. Because the Constitution itself says the enumeration of certain rights, like a right to due process of law, shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Well, where is the right to life enumerated in the Constitution? Nowhere. The due process of clause is predicated on the fact that it's there, but where is it? It's held by the people. Well, if it's held by the people, how do they protect it? Through the 10th Amendment. The powers not given to the federal government are retained by the people in the states.
Mm-hmm.
So if your listeners could picture this bowl of all rights, and you know, they come from, we know them from history and tradition and common law, from natural law. You know, Blackstone and Cook and all those, they articulated them in their treaties. It says, so there's this bowl, and the founder said, some of these are so important, we want to make sure the federal government doesn't think it controls them. And so they enumerated religious liberty. They enumerated the right to keep and bear arms, against search and seizure, against self-incrimination, against laws making something criminal ex post facto after you've already done it and you can't change your behavior. They enumerated 8 of them. And then they said in the 9th, but the fact that I took some out of this bowl and put them up here and enumerated them shall not be construed to deny or disparage that there are others still sitting in that bowl. And when you construe due process of law to obliterate the right of persons to life, you have construed the enumerated right to deny or disparage the fundamental right to life.
Right. Which you're saying, of course, the Constitution and particularly the 14th Amendment really can't be understood if that right to life is not acknowledged as existing, right? I mean, the rest of it just wouldn't make sense. And then, of course, I guess you could add to that, David, the fact that the right to life is explicitly mentioned in the Declaration, which, of course, the Declaration of Independence is laying out the principles. The Constitution is laying out the mechanism of government. So, I mean, you take those facts together and it's like, again, to summarize what you're saying, the states are the ones who enforce and protect this right to life, which is there in the common law, which the Constitution says, don't think that there aren't a whole bunch of other rights there that we have not mentioned.
That's right. So in essence, the Ninth Amendment acknowledges what you and I would call fundamental law or pre-political law. It would acknowledge that there's a law we would say is given to us by our Creator, that it exists for human society, and it exists part of the Constitution. And what the Ninth Amendment is saying, the fact that I've articulated some of these does not mean that that's all of them. There are other pre-existing laws and rights. And and you know, this is going to be important for when it comes to marriage. Marriage did not come from the government deciding to create a license. Parental rights don't come from the fact that the government gives you a birth certificate. You know, there are so many issues that the Ninth Amendment could be used for to say, you can't take away from my state the ability to govern these normal, everyday matters of life, liberty, and property unless I violate equal protection or due process of law. Now, right. Father Frank, here's the critical part about the Ninth Amendment argument, is that the Ninth Amendment argument takes a constitutional provision and says, for example, you must interpret the 14th Amendment the way Marianne Glennon and John Finnis and Robbie George and others are saying, that persons are unborn and they have a right to life. Once that's established, that the unborn are persons in the law, then Section 5 of the 14th Amendment says that Congress has the power to enforce these requirements of the 14th Amendment. Now, what does this mean? If the unborn are persons and states allow persons to be killed without due process of law, if they treat some persons as real persons and other persons, the unborn, as non-persons, that's equal protection. Congress would have the power to step in under Section 5 to enforce on the states the requirement that you give all persons due process of law and treat all persons equally. We don't need a constitutional amendment. We already have adopted it. All we need is for the court to recognize what the common law said, is that the unborn are persons.
Right, right.
Once they're persons, the states can't discriminate against them, nor can they take their life without due process of law, and Congress can fix it.
Well, let me mention, for those that are just joining us, we're talking with David Fowler, who's president of the Family Action Council of Tennessee, and he has authored this brief to the Supreme Court in the Dobbs abortion case, and we're discussing this brief together with the other briefs in this series, this educational series, preparing for this case. David, I want to bring up another matter. It arises here in the brief. I remember it brought to my mind a dinner I was at with Justice Clarence Thomas one time, and he was speaking to a small group, and he brought up this question of substantive due process. And I remember him standing there saying to this group, you know, we justices tend to make up these terminologies. And he says, you ask us, what do we mean by this? He says, I don't know. We just make it up. And you know, he was so down to earth and direct about it. And I think in a more nuanced way, some of this is coming across in this brief. What should people understand by substantive due process? And how has that concept been misused in this context of the right to life?
Yeah, that's a very important point, because the Fifth Amendment, of course, has a due process clause, as does the 14th Amendment. And what you and I would call it, if we just read it as lay people, we would say you can't deprive a person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So we would say, oh, that's a procedural requirement. It's saying that before a person can be deprived of their life, you have to prove that, well, David came over and punched Father Frank in the face and broke his jaw. He committed a wrong. Now you have to have a jury trial. That's procedural, to prove that he did it. And now he's going to lose some of his property to pay damages to Father Frank. That's what due process of law is, procedural. But the Supreme Court said, oh, but it has a substantive component because it uses the word law. Yeah, but the law is not made by courts. Courts Right. make judgments. Legislative bodies make law. In fact, after the 14th Amendment was adopted, the Supreme Court interpreted the 14th Amendment. It's a case from, I think, 1884, Hurtado versus California. This is still good law. Clarence Thomas actually used this case in the marriage decision. That's where I found it, from Clarence Thomas, who you just mentioned. And he said, well, we said in Hurtado versus California that because the same language is used in the Fifth Amendment as used in the 14th Amendment, it must mean the same thing. Okay, and that's a normal rule of construction. You wouldn't read the Bible and say, in the beginning, God created the earth, and every time you ran into the word God, say, Well, I wonder what God that one is.
It's whatever
the first one was, right? And so in Hurtado, again, cited by Justice Thomas, he said they must mean the same thing. The rule of law, which we hear this all the time, the law of land, excuse me, Supreme Court holdings are the law of the land. The Constitution is the law of the land. The Supreme Court said, actually, the law of the land is made by Congress. Because Congress makes law. Courts don't make law. The Supreme Court could never make the law of the land. It decides how to settle a dispute between a couple of particular parties, but that's as far as it can go. It's applying a pre-existing, already made law. Law made by states, laws made by Congress, the law of the Constitution. And so what this the Supreme Court did is they ignored that opinion, which also said the due process clause must be interpreted according to the common law. How do you like that? That's what the Supreme Court said. They ignored it. So one, I want to give my thanks publicly to Justice Thomas for bringing to my light a case that I don't remember reading in law school that makes the very point that you can't construe a procedural requirement into a substantive requirement, particularly if you divorce it from the common law.
Right.
Now, substantive due process is the court creating something more than procedure. Did you pass a law that said, don't punch people in the face? Did you provide for a jury trial and so on and so forth and cross-examination of witnesses and the right to an attorney and all? Then it's a fair process. Okay, now Fowler can have to pay damages, go to jail for assault and battery. And they said, no, but there's a substantive component. Well, once you say that, you're conceding that you're now getting ready to make law.
Mm-hmm.
Courts can't make law. But then what they did is they took the word liberty in the phrase life, liberty, or property, and they divorced it from the common law to say liberty is essentially whatever we think a person ought to be free to do.
Mm.
Well, liberty was not the freedom to do anything you wanted to do. It was the freedom to move about. That was what liberty meant. Again, Clarence Thomas said that in the Obergefell decision. This is a newfangled understanding of liberty.
Yeah.
To require a marriage license? How do you require a legislative body to pass a law for a license? How do you have a liberty to go kill another person? So he pointed that out. He said liberty is the ability to move around. So the Supreme Court has done so. It's like error on top of error,
right,
and then refusing for 48 years to admit the error.
Well, we are at a critical moment, as I'm sure you would agree, and the authors of all the other briefs in this case, where the court does have an opportunity to correct the errors that were there in Roe v. Wade right from the beginning. You know, some people talk about precedent and longstanding precedent, but as Justice Thomas and others have pointed out, if precedent was constitutionally wrong from square one, the passage of time doesn't make it right. And we got an opportunity here to really fix this. The court has the opportunity. David, I want to thank you for explaining more about your brief. I want to thank you for the work that you and Tom Smith and others have done on it. Thanks for all the service that you've rendered to the cause of life and family and freedom in your time as a legislator, in your work with this Family Action Council and all your other advocacy. Great to have you with us, and we'll certainly keep in touch as this case progresses, hopefully, prayerfully, to a point of victory sometime Amen. Next year.
Amen.
So God bless you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And friends, I want to remind you that SupremeCourtVictory.com is a special website where we've developed, where you can read the briefs, including the one that we've just been discussing, and where you can find a prayer for victory in this Supreme Court case. So we ask you to go there, educate yourself about this case, watch our other interviews with other friends of the court, and pray that prayer for victory. Victory for freedom, victory for the unborn. God bless you all, friends. Father Frank Pavone here of Priests for Life. We will talk to you soon.
This has been the End Abortion Podcast. To learn more, to help end abortion, and to connect with us on social media, visit endabortion.net.